This is Indie Week. For our blind and print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service presents me, John Federson, with this week's issue. And I hear all you clamoring to know, well, John, what is the recording date of this issue? Well, it's February the 2nd, 2023. And since I did see my own shadow just now, it looks like we're in for 60 minutes more of broadcast, beginning just about now. Okay, beginning from the Indie Week online, indieweek.com, a little more current articles than what is in the print version, by Greg Childress about K-12 teaching vacancies. On the first day of school in August, North Carolina Public Schools reported a 46% increase in teacher vacancies when compared to the previous year. A look in on the day 40 showed a 58% jump in vacancies. The data in a new report released Wednesday during the State Board of Education's monthly meeting show the state with 5,500 vacancies on the first day of school, compared with 3,800 the previous year. And there's a full there's a link in the online to the full State of the Teaching Profession report. On the 40th day of school, there were 5,000 vacancies compared to 3,200 during the 21-2 school year. North Carolina teachers marched for better pay. Teacher vacancies have been a major concern for school leaders in recent years, mainly due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Teachers leaving the profession have cited low pay and pandemic-related trauma. And some teachers share that the culture war around critical race theory, LGBTQ issues, and book bans have left them feeling disrespected and underappreciated. This week, Andrew Houlihan, superintendent of Union County Schools, told attendees of the Public School Forum of North Carolina Eggs and Issues that teacher vacancies hit his district hard this year. He said his district is high-performing and has not traditionally had recruitment or retention problems. Until about 2 years ago, he said, where we looked around the room and said, oh my gosh, we cannot find a kindergarten teacher. Under state law, a teaching position is considered vacant if it is not filled by a licensed teacher in a permanent assignment, filled by a long-term substitute or interim teacher, or filled by a teacher with an emergency license, permit to teacher, or provisional license. Thomas Tomberlin, Senior Director of Educator Preparation, Licensure, and Performance at NC Department of Public Instruction, said the vacancy rate is overstated. Tomberlin said 3,600 people who hold a permit to teach or provisional license are teaching, but the positions are counted as vacant because they don't meet the definition of a permanent teacher. Quote, I think it's very unfortunate that this may be construed as there's this massive increase in the number of vacancies. What has changed is we enforced the methodology that's prescribed in law so that we're accurately reporting to the General Assembly the state of our teaching profession. Schools had the most trouble filling K-5 vacancies in core subjects like math, reading, science, and social studies. There were 1,200 vacancies in those subjects. And vacancies in exceptional children programs across grades K-12 were also difficult to fill. The report showed that North Carolina teacher attrition rate holding steady at a little under 8%. That's about 8,000 of nearly 94,000 teachers. The attrition rate represents a slight decrease over the previous year when it was 8.2. That year, 7,700 of 94,000 left the state's public schools. Most teachers cite personal reasons for leaving. Tomberlin added, my report to you, the board, is that attrition in the state of North Carolina is one of the most stable metrics we have. It's annually right around the same number every year. Teacher mobility, which shows educators moving from one school to another in the state, increased slightly from 3.3%. The rate was 3.24% the year before. Next from Jasmine Gallup. Raleigh Police Department faces tough questions after depositions in a no-knock lawsuit. Two black families were forced to answer racist questions in a deposition last month as they fought for justice over the Raleigh Police Department's illegal entry into their homes. Yolanda Irving and Kenya Walton, whose homes were raided in May 2020 after police entered with no warning, are suing the city of Raleigh for compensation for loss of liberty, physical pain and injuries, serious psychological and emotional damage, and loss of quality of life, according to the complaint. The two mothers, along with legal counsel, nonprofit Emancipate NC, held a press conference Monday to speak out about their experiences and the treatment they faced during the lawsuit, which has been ongoing for nearly a year. Irving said, "We want justice, and that's what we're standing here for. We were two moms that were just minding our business, going about our day, and they interrupted our lives. They chased me and Ms. Walton's kids down with guns, and they were innocent." In response to the lawsuit, the city hired four private law firms in addition to two city attorneys for a defense. According to Emancipate North Carolina, the city's strategy, quote, has included accusing these innocent mothers and children of criminal wrongdoing and subjected them to a battery of invasive and inappropriate questions, wrote attorneys Ian Mance and Elizabeth Simpson in an open letter to the Raleigh City Council. Quote, lines of questioning have included, are you in touch with your birth father at all? Have you ever been? When was the last time you had a job, if ever? Do you have a particular rap artist you like? What's the significance of your tattoos? Wrote the attorneys. Lawyers also questioned the children about the activities of street gangs in their neighborhood. Manson Simpson wrote, playing on their reasonable fears for their personal safety. Walton said that the deposition was disgusting, not fair. It opened up wounds that shouldn't have been opened, questions the kids shouldn't have to go through. Manson Simpson put it more bluntly. These questions are inappropriate, are steeped in racial stereotypes, and have been put to our clients despite a total absence of evidence that they or the SEU raid at issue had any connection to gang activity. The raid itself was a result of an incorrect address on the search warrant. The picture of the house is correct, but the address of Irving's home is wrong. Police also entered the home of Irving's next-door neighbor, Walton, for which they had no warrant at all. In addition, the warrant was obtained by disgraced former Raleigh police officer Omar Abdullah, who was fired in 2021 after he worked with a corrupt informant to jail a dozen black men on false drug charges. All in all, City of Raleigh leaders have some tough questions to answer, including why they continue to fight against a lawsuit that seems cut and dry. Kerwin Pittman, Emancipate NC's policy director, during the press conference, quote, "Why are you not righting this wrong? Why are you continuing to victimize this family that was already victimized the first time by the Raleigh Police Department?" Next from Lynn Bonner, originally published online at North Carolina Policy Watch. Carlton Huffman had a long record of espousing controversial views about race, immigrants, and North Carolina history before he started a job with the General Assembly earlier this month. According to an online staff listing, Huffman was on the staff of the Joint Legislative Committee of Governmental Operations, working for the House Republican majority. That brief tenure ended yesterday, however, when, as first reported by WRAL, Huffman resigned. He had appeared on a far-right radio show in 2009 and 10 called The Political Cesspool. On one episode, he discussed, quote, cultural genocide in the South. In another, about European politics, Huffman praised Dutch politician Geert Wilders as a firebrand critic of Islam who, quote, stands up for our European people. He lauded the far-right British National Party, which wants to end all immigration into Britain for, quote, standing up for the white Europeans left in Great Britain. An anonymous tip about Huffman, emailed to journalists Wednesday, included links to a political cesspool radio interview and blog posts in which Huffman allegedly used a pseudonym. He told WRAL he was once a member of the White Supremacist Council of Conservative Citizens, but left when it openly expressed anti-Semitism. Huffman did not return a phone call made to his office Wednesday afternoon. WRAL quoted Huffman disavowing the views he previously espoused. This is at least the second time Huffman worked at the legislature. While working for former Republican Rep. Jonathan Jordan in 2011, Huffman left an anonymous letter on state senators' desks before they were to begin debate on pardoning former Governor William Holden, governor from 1868 to 1871, and was impeached for his efforts to suppress the Ku Klux Klan in Alamance County. Huffman's letter attacked Holden as corrupt. Leaving information anonymously on senators' desks was against Senate rules, and Huffman resigned from his job with Jordan soon afterwards. In a brief interview on Thursday, House Speaker Tim Moore told Policy Watch he did not remember the anonymous letter from 2011 and knew nothing about Huffman's radio interviews or writings. His recent Facebook posts appear not to reflect some of his views from the early 2000s. He had posted a photo of civil rights icons Martin Luther King Jr. and John Lewis to the page on January 15th and has previously commemorated Juneteenth. Last June, CNN reported Huffman was among many who texted former President Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows on January 6th, pleading with him to help halt the insurrection on Capitol Hill. At 2:34 p.m., strategist Carlton Huffman wrote, to quote, "You've earned a special place in infamy for the events of today, and if you're the Christian you claim to be in your heart, you know that." On his LinkedIn page, which still lists the North Carolina House job as of yesterday, he describes himself as a conservative patriot and lists recent work as regional field director for Herschel Walker for Senate campaign, political director for the recently unsuccessful Wisconsin Republican Attorney General candidate Eric Toney, and three other positions, including 6 years with the Republican Party of Wisconsin. Next, from Joe Killian, originally published in NC Policy Watch. When a federal district court judge ruled last year that the North Carolina State Health Plan's exclusion of gender-affirming treatments for transgender people was discriminatory and unconstitutional, the state's LGBTQ community celebrated victory in a legal fight it had been waging since 2019. But that decision is being revisited on appeal this month in a political environment in which conservative activists, politicians, and lawmakers increasingly portray transgender people as mentally ill, those who support them as a threat to children, and doctors who treat them as mutilators. State Treasurer Dale Folwell, whose office administers the plan, has championed and strongly defended the exclusion of transgender care since taking office in 2017. He's also considering a run for governor next year, which could set up a Republican primary battle with Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, whose fiery anti-LGBTQ statements have become a defining element of his political identity. He said in a speech to a Baptist church in Winston-Salem in 2021, "I don't care how much you cut yourself up, drug yourself up, and dress yourself up, you're either one of two things. You're either a man or a woman. You might be a cut-up, dressed-up, drugged-up, ugly man or woman, but you're still a man or a woman, and I don't care who doesn't like it." Opposition to gender transition plays well with segments of the Republican base. Robinson has repeatedly mocked transgender people and characterized them as filth. That grabs headlines, but the relative powerlessness of Robinson's office doesn't allow for much in the way of real-world policy action on the issue. Falwell's exclusion of gender-affirming care from the state health plan, along with his willingness to wage long court battles to preserve the exclusion, has been praised by conservative activists as less dramatic but more tangible. Tammy Fitzgerald, executive director of the NC Values Coalition, praised Falwell in a statement last week on the appeal. Quote, taxpayers should not be forced to fund elective sex change and hormone therapy, which often result in emotional devastation and regret after healthy body parts are amputated and permanent damage is done. In doing so, we are also enabling the culture's dangerous narrative that gender is fluid and that medical procedures can actually change someone's gender. These procedures not only damage the gender confused, but also open the state up for liability for genital mutilation and emotional distress, which often cause long-term medical problems. Fitzgerald, Tammy Fitzgerald's statements, are at odds with more than 40 years of research and treatment of transgender people and the positions of both the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association, which consider the treatment at issue necessary and in some cases life-saving. But they are indicative of right-wing sentiments that will carry a lot of weight in a Republican primary. Having their personal identities and medical treatment discussed in political and legal terms makes transgender North Carolinians feel like political pawns in a game that is, for many of them, life and death. Julia McCowan, an associate professor at NC State University College of Education and one of the plaintiffs in the suit, said, I am disappointed to see North Carolina officials, particularly Dale Falwell, doubling down on their discriminatory effort to deny me and others critical medical care by pursuing this appeal. I hope that the Court of Appeals affirms our win and we can finally put this issue to rest. The state health plan, overseen by Falwell's office and a 10-member board composed largely of political appointees, provides coverage for more than 750,000 state employees and dependents. Last week, before a 3-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, attorney John Knepper defended a blanket exclusion for gender-affirming care in the plan. His argument? The state doesn't discriminate against all transgender people because not all transgender people experience gender dysphoria, a psychological term for a significant and prolonged conflict between one's gender identity and the gender they are assigned at birth. Knepper said, the record is clear there are transgender people who have gender dysphoria and would seek these changes, seek this medical care and would have physicians recommending it. And there are transgender people who don't have dysphoria and have either no desire or medical recommendation to receive this care. There are transgender people on both sides of the ledger, so it's not a facial classification of transgender people. Chief Judge Robert Gregory said some people not being interested in services to which they should have access doesn't make sense as an explanation for eliminating the whole group's access. Gregory, who is black, said, that's like saying we have facial discrimination against blacks, but it's okay because there are some black people who don't care about going to a restaurant at all, others who do. We don't look at that, their clothes, whether there's some transgender people who don't need these services. You cut that off categorically. Gregory was a recess appointment of former President Bill Clinton, who was later nominated to the same position by former President George W. Bush. Throughout last week's oral arguments, he expressed strong skepticism of the state health plan's exclusion. At times, he clashed with Knepper, at one point chiding him for shaking his head while the judge was attempting to make a point. Judge Stephen Agee, who was also a nominee of former President Bush, was more sympathetic to Knepper's positions throughout the oral arguments. He firmly questioned Tara Borelli, senior counsel at Lambda Legal, during her argument for the plaintiffs, but without apparent tension. Judge Albert Diaz, a nominee of former President Barack Obama, was relatively quiet through the arguments as Gregory and AG dominated the back and forth with the opposing attorneys. Borelli told the 3-judge panel, what they're asking this court to do is pick up its judicial pen and rescue this exclusion by rewriting it. because the one they've adopted and the one they actually have to defend is so indefensible. It so plainly and clearly discriminates based on sex and transgender status. North Carolina was, pardon me, one of a number of states that began covering medically necessary treatment for transgender people in 2017 to comply with federal non-discrimination laws. That includes everything from talk therapy related to gender transition to hormone therapy and some surgeries. But when Folwell came to office, he dismissed that coverage as unnecessary, too expensive, and out of step with his primary goal of cutting costs. He and the State Health Board's Board of Trustees let the extension of coverage for transgender treatment lapse. In the face of criticism and lawsuits, Falwell defended the exemption. Quote, until the court system, a legislative body, or voters tell us that we have to, when to, and how to spend taxpayers' money on sex change operations, I will not make a decision that has the potential to discriminate against those who desire other currently uncovered elective non-emergency procedures. Sex change operation is not a term used by medical professionals treating transgender people, insurance companies, or the LGBTQ community. It is widely considered offensive, both because of its technical inaccuracy and because a wide array of procedures, not just one operation, are utilized in gender transition. Knepper and Borelli, in debating the exclusion before the court panel last week, repeatedly apologized for having to use the term and related terms when quoting writings and opinions on the subject from years ago. Last year, when U.S. District Judge Loretta Biggs ruled against the plan's exclusion, Falwell's office restored the coverage, but also moved immediately to appeal the decision. Policy Watch has reached out to Falwell for comment on the appeal, but calls were not returned. As Biggs wrote in her ruling last year, a key point in the case is whether excluding treatments related to gender dysphoria necessarily discriminate against transgender people. Biggs wrote, on its face, the exclusion bars coverage for treatment in conjunction with proposed gender transformation and sex changes or modifications. The characteristic of sex and gender are directly implicated. It's impossible to refer to the exclusion without referring to them. Quote, state defendants attempt to frame the exclusion as one focused on medical diagnoses, not gender, Biggs wrote. However, the diagnosis at issue, dysphoria, only results from a discrepancy between assigned sex and gender identity. An employer cannot be permitted to use a technically neutral classification as a proxy to evade the prohibition of intentional discrimination, such as gray hair as a proxy for age. In short, the exclusion facially discriminates on the basis of gender, and heightened scrutiny applies. Now, there's a criteria portion of this article, gender dysphoria, a marked incongruence between one's experienced or expressed gender and assigned gender of at least 6 month duration, as manifested by at least two or more of the following symptoms. A marked incongruence between one's experienced and expressed gender and primary and or secondary sex characteristics, or in young adolescent, the anticipated secondary characteristics. A strong desire to be rid of one's primary and or secondary sex characteristics because of the marked incongruence with one experienced expressed gender. A strong desire for the primary and or secondary sex characteristics of the other gender. A strong desire to be of the other gender or some alternative gender different from one's assigned. A strong desire to be treated as the other gender. A strong conviction that one has the typical feelings and reactions of the other gender. And the condition is associated with clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. Now, I've encapsulated that sidebar about what dysphoria, the criteria for dysphoria. How best to treat it remains a debate even within LGBTQ community. Its more nuanced definition as a diagnosis was seen as a step forward as compared to transgender identity itself being considered a disorder. Its definition has also gone a long way toward helping transgender people access medical care and legal recognition they've long sought. In many ways, transgender identity has mirrored the path of homosexuality in terms of mainstream and medical acceptance. When the first edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders was published in 1952, homosexuality was included as a psychological disorder. With further study and debate, that was changed in 1974 to a diagnosis for those distressed by their homosexuality. By 2013, that too was removed. Many LGBTQ advocates say they look forward to a day when transgender identity is so widely accepted that a medical diagnosis is no longer part of their fight for medical and legal rights. But for now, political debates and legal fights over who is transgender, how they should be treated when experiencing dysphoria, and whether and how they can legally change their legal gender continue. Last year, transgender people born in North Carolina prevailed in a lawsuit over changing the gender marker on their birth certificates without being required to medically transition. It isn't clear when the appeals court will make its decision on the state health plan, but Borelli, the attorney for the plaintiffs, told Policy Watch she believes the original district court opinion will hold up. Quote, "That's the trend we're seeing across the country on these sorts of exclusions. The courts continue to make clear that they are discriminatory." Now to our print edition from Indy. Orders unserved about protective orders. Adejiwan Ojibwobo from Durham writes this article. Rocks struck the brown vinyl exterior of Daly's Durham home last November. Like a baseball player, her ex-boyfriend pitched each rock with a grin as she crouched behind a faded couch in the living room with her mother. While yelling dumb b and other profanities in Spanish, he toggled between anger and sadness. Their relationship now over, he begged her to believe that he hadn't cheated on her. They had been apart for 3 months, but he was not ready to let go. Daly, 19, said he didn't take it well in a phone interview as her mother interpreted her Spanish. The Ninth Street Journal is not fully identifying Daly for her protection. "We didn't work as a couple anyways. The cheating thing was just another reason I needed to break up." With the screen door closed for protection, Daly's father opened the front door to scare the 22-year-old away as he continued to launch rocks at the house from the lawn. "Leave!" the father yelled in Spanish. He didn't. 3 weeks later, on a Wednesday morning, Daly was in Durham County Domestic Violence Court seeking a one-year protective order against the ex-boyfriend. Her father stood beside her. Throughout the hearing, the soft-spoken Daly constantly looked to her dad, but Judge Nancy Gordon had bad news. "This court can't help you," she said. Daly was one of the plaintiffs in court that morning seeking protective orders against people they once loved, but she left court with the same temporary restraining order she came in with. Her journey in court began 10 days earlier when the judge approved a temporary protective order against her former partner. In such cases, the sheriff's office is supposed to serve the order to the defendant within 10 days. By then, both defendant and plaintiff must be present at what's known as the return hearing. That's when a judge decides whether to extend the temporary order to 1 year. But if a deputy cannot deliver the temporary order to the defendant, the entire process comes to a halt. A defendant can't show up for the return hearing if he doesn't know that the restraining order exists. And then by law, a judge can't make a decision about the year-long order, which means that plaintiffs like Daly show up for the return hearing only to learn that the court must postpone the proceeding until the defendant is served, and that may never happen. In 2021, Durham deputies attempted to serve orders about 1,000 times, but were successful on about 440 of them. That's a 50% failure rate. There's a marked increase over 2019 and 20, when the failure rates were 39% and 43%, respectively. Sheriff's statistics from January to September of last year showed that only 18% had failed, though conventional wisdom holds that domestic violence reports typically increase significantly during the winter. In an email to the Ninth Street Journal, Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead said two deputies in his domestic violence unit serve protection orders. Patrol and transportation deputies also serve orders if needed. Asked to elaborate, Burkhead did not provide details as to how or when patrol and transportation deputies are assigned to help the two-member domestic violence unit. Durham County's challenges mirror the rest of the state's, said Nisha Williams, legal director at the NC Coalition Against Domestic Violence. You only have but so many people available to do the service, she said. In Durham, the sheriff's office typically attempts to serve the order at least once before the return hearing date. In Daly's case, that meant that a Durham deputy showed up at her ex-boyfriend's listed address, but no one was apparently there. The problem is, deputies are generally unable to try again to serve the order before the date of the return hearing. However, according to Burkhead, 90% of domestic violence orders are being served before the 10-day hearing date. Sheriff's Office spokesman David Bowser later clarified that 90% rate referred to attempts. Greg was in court the same morning that Daly and her father were. He was there seeking a year-long order against his cousin, Laura. According to court documents, after Greg told Laura not to contact him in August, she called him 7 times in 20 days. In that same period, she called his stepmother 14 times and his father 21 times. Nobody called her back. Greg said, Laura's a lunatic. The Ninth Street Journal is not fully identifying Greg to protect his family's privacy. Their families had been close but had a falling out earlier this year. Since then, Greg told the court, Laura has instigated conflict and harassed family members. One time, she demanded Greg give her a free tattoo at his parlor. After Greg refused, she repeatedly called, texted, and left him voicemails. She threatened to break into his house. Another time, she said she would hire someone to hurt his girlfriend. But after Greg secured that temporary protective order, deputies weren't able to serve her. So, like Daly, the judge had bad news for him too that Wednesday. This court has not acquired jurisdiction to be able to help you. Since the pandemic, staffing shortages have crippled the sheriff's office. Last year, Burkhead told radio station 97.9 The Hill that the office was 75 employees short of its intended capacity. But when Ninth Street Journal asked about staffing, Burkhead referenced a recent community forum during which a North Carolina domestic violence specialist said, quote, Durham knocks it out of the park every single time, referring to the sheriff's office successfully serving protective orders. Others maintain that staffing shortages are indeed a problem. Gigi Warner, Durham legal aid supervising attorney for domestic violence, said the sheriff's office, especially in the past 2 years, has had a very hard time with staffing and with allocating resources to service. The deputy, whose primary job was to get orders served, they're now having to do many other responsibilities because of staff shortages. The upshot, she said, getting defendants served is an issue. Deputies didn't find Daly's ex-boyfriend at the address she gave the court during her initial hearing 10 days earlier. Gordon said, it's important that you have the best address possible to be able to help the police find him. In Daly's case, it's unclear exactly why the deputy couldn't find her ex-boyfriend. She's confident she gave the best address. "The address that we gave out is the address where he lives at," she said in Spanish. "He might have been at the shop," referencing the auto repair business where her ex works. Williams of the NCCADV said, "This is a common problem for deputies. Defendants aren't at home when law enforcement is there to serve them. Sometimes," he also noted, "the defendant is actually hiding. And sometimes defendants won't answer the door." According to court documents, the sheriff's office does ask what time of day the defendant is typically at the home and work address provided. In an email to Ninth Street Journal, Bowser said, "With all civil process, lawsuits, writs, domestic protective orders, etc., DCSO makes multiple service attempts before returning process unserved." Nonetheless, Williams says, if you don't have law enforcement around the clock trying to get that service, it's going to take a while. In an interview, District Court Judge Amanda Maris, who rotates regularly through domestic violence civil court, said, "It's not just about having more bodies. It's about the sheriffs having all the information they need to have the correct address." Deputies successfully served orders 373 times, served orders 373 times in 457 attempts between January and September of 2022, according to data from the sheriff's office. But when they fail, Williams says, deputy sheriffs need to be able to reattempt service at different times before the return hearing date. Greg chuckled in open court when the judge said deputies had been unable to find Laura. He said, "Laura is probably just bouncing around Charlotte with some random dude." The sheriff's office works with local law enforcement in other counties and states to serve defendants. Laura will be added to the list. Well, now, a cover story from the print edition of Indie Week, of Indie, is a stage article by Jasmine Gallup about Goodnight's Comedy Club in Raleigh. It's reviving the city's late-night scene with a new location in the Village District. Old-timers know that as Cameron Village, of course. Goodnight's Comedy, a cornerstone of the Raleigh stand-up scene for more than 30 years, is going underground. The climb down into the legendary club's new location in the Village District is reminiscent of a late Friday night at college, stumbling down a narrow flight of stairs into a tiny black-box theater where you push your way through the crowd, only to find yourself crushed into a corner. This new Goodnight space, 401 Woodburn Road, is much more spacious than those infamous makeshift stages in Chicago, often found in dingy basements. But on a Friday night, you still have to push your way through the crowd to get to the solid wood bar or find a seat in the tiered performance space. Goodnight's owner, Brad Grossman, says, "When we found this underground space, that was the moment where we're like, yeah, this is what we have to do. Go underground where people can just laugh and forget about life on Main Street." Grossman has been hard at work finishing the new space after moving out of the old location in a historic ice cream factory over on West Morgan Street in July of last year. The move to Woodburn Road in January of this year was a chance to finally mimic the underground design of his first business venture, Helium Comedy Club in Philadelphia, a favorite among audiences, he said. Quote, "The way Goodnight's was built 40 years ago didn't match the needs of a comedy fan. Sometimes you want to go underground and learn and talk and laugh at the most ridiculous things in life." After the seriousness of the past few years, Grossman says, "Now is the time to relearn how to laugh. That's what Goodnight's and comedy bring to the community. It's an opportunity to sit back and just take a break from everyday life, have a drink, enjoy a laugh. That's pretty important." The entrance to Goodnight's, camouflaged on a corner just a few yards right of Flying Biscuit, was easy to spot 2 weeks ago on January the 20th during the club's opening weekend. Dozens of people spilled out onto the sidewalk, lining up to see the first of many headliners in the new space, podcaster and Comedy Central regular Anthony Jeselnik. George May, who made the four-hour drive with his old college friend, Michael Almont, he said, "We live in South Carolina, actually. We came up for the show. We love Jeselnik. We just saw he was touring, and this was one of the closer spots." May and Almonte had never been to Good Nights before, but they were thrilled when they heard they could catch one of their favorite comics here, says May. He enjoys Jeselnik's dark humor and misdirections. As far as the space goes, it's dope, Almonte asserts. On Friday night, the crowd is loud, chatting and laughing even before the show starts. It's a full house, with couples and groups of friends sitting at every table, sipping wine, swigging beer next to bare brick walls. The underground space is dimly lit, creating an intimate atmosphere even with an audience of more than 300. The first opener, Jason Seabrooks, walks on to a burst of music so loud you can feel the vibrations of the bass. As soon as he enters, there's nothing but the spotlight and the mic and, of course, the guy on stage, talking about how messed up life is and somehow getting you to laugh at it. Seabrooks has plenty of in-jokes for North Carolina natives, taking digs at Johnston County with one breath and the audience itself at the next. The next comic, Blair Sochi, treads farther over the line, making blunt observations about abortion restrictions and degrading North Carolina's anti-abortion stance. She's saying things a lot of people might think, but never speak out loud. It's a relief and catharsis all wrapped up in a surprisingly raspy voice. Back in the good old days, the village had a thriving underground complex, thousands of square feet of nightclubs, music venues, and quirky stores. From the early 70s through the mid-80s, the village underground was known for its live music scene, welcoming local legends as well as nationally renowned bands, including R.E.M., The Ramones, Pat Benatar, Bette Midler, and even Duke Ellington. Now, Goodnights is right across from where that once bustling hotspot lived. That was big, says Grossman. Quote, "I get to kind of revitalize what the community remembered about this area, which was the village underground. To see people come through here opening night and just shake their head and smile, you know you did something right." Patrons agree. Ruth Seiler, who came to the club's opening weekend with her husband Colin, talks about the village former underground scene fondly. Quote, "I remember when it was bargain box down here, when it was the retail. My mom knew it for the underground club scene. Goodnights is the perfect addition to this area. It feels like it's been here forever." Plenty of popular comedians are slated to appear in the next few months, including Matt Rife, Rachel Feinstein, and Adam Carolla, among others. But welcoming well-known faces from HBO and Netflix is only one part of what Grossman is trying to achieve with Goodnights and its next chapter, he said. A few days before opening weekend, it was Helen Wildey on the stage, a local comic who moved to Raleigh from Seattle after starting her comedy career in Pittsburgh. In mid-January, she recorded her debut album, thanks to support from Grossman and his recording studio, Helium Comedy Records. Wildey says, "It's the biggest thing that's happened to my comedy career so far," adding she's excited to see several other comics also set to record their debut albums in the new space. Wildey has also performed at Goodnight's old location and its village pop-up, earning the hat trick of Goodnight's, she says, with a laugh. "The new club felt like an instant classic," she adds. "I've been in a lot of comedy clubs all over America, and the vibe is so perfect. An underground club is always best. It has lower ceilings, traps in the laughter, just makes better shows." She calls the Raleigh comedy scene wonderful. "The amount of talent here is wild. It blows my mind all the time. Everyone's been so welcoming and friendly of new people coming to the scene. And Good Nights has been so great at highlighting local performers and really giving them a platform. It's lovely to have a club that's so supportive, as well as bringing out all this insane national talent. In addition to the expansive main stage, Good Nights also has a small performance space, room 861, named after the club's old location. Grossman said, "It really gives local and up-and-coming comedians an opportunity to perform when otherwise you would just have a big name on Saturday nights. Arguably, the show in here will be funnier because maybe the comedians are working that much harder. It's a toss-up." Grossman and his brother Mark want to grow the local comedy industry, he says. They're using their recording studio to shoot specials for people you've never heard of. And he goes on, "We need to get more people into this room 861 to understand that it's a nice space to have a drink or go see a show in a small room. It's just a different experience. If we can grow talent, whether it's on our stages or online, that grows the industry. And it's good for everybody." Well, in my time remaining, let's talk about bagels. A homegrown Durham bagel company finds a cult following and lands themselves a brick and mortar. Lena Geller writing this article about Isaac's Bagels. It's 6 a.m. and there's no music playing in the kitchen this morning, but there is nevertheless a certain dance to behold between Isaac Henrion and his clocked-in baker, Leah Fiacco, who have been working since 4 and have exactly 3 more hours to boil, seed, and bake 1,200 rings of dough without ramming each other with hot sheet pans or slipping on sesame seeds which coat the floor in a perpetual booby trap. Indeed, bagel making is a ballet of sorts, an art form with little room for error, but endless room for expression. Making bagels demands equal doses of precision and vision. It's a sensible niche for Henrion, a British expat who spent years working as a computer scientist before a series of pandemic-era pivots led him to the food industry. In the kitchen, he ties his hair back with a butterfly-spotted bandana, chatters about hydration levels and protein percentages, and whirls between ovens with the buoyancy of a man who has figured out how to reach through the computer screen, Wonka Vision style, and hold the product of his calculation in his hands. Soon enough, Henrion, 30, will be dancing on his own stage. Isaac's Bagels, a business he launched 2 years ago that slowly accrued a cult following and currently operates out of a commissary kitchen, is set to open as a brick-and-mortar shop on West Chapel Hill Street in Durham this fall. For now, though, the production is limited to the commissary space where Henrion and his team bake 7 varieties of bagel each week to distribute at the Durham Co-op, Jewish for Good, and the Durham Farmers Market. This morning's batch began 2 days earlier, on Thursday, with the mixing and shaping of the dough. 48 hours later, after the dough rings have puffed up like little inner tubes, they get boiled in a large pot, a cauldron, as Henrion calls it, before being dunked in seeds, placed on pans, and pushed into the oven. The ovens have hot and cold spots, so Henrion rearranges the bagels every few minutes to ensure an even bake. It's sort of like watching a card dealer perform an elaborate game of three-card Monte. After the bagels have cooked and cooled, he sorts out the clunkers. He lobs an onion bagel into a tub of rejects and says, "If they've got no belly button and they're a baseball, they're not making it." He listens to the bagel hit the bottom of the can. That sad thump of failure. On Instagram and TikTok, Henrion continues, there's a recent trend among bagel shops called the knock test, where a person is shown wrapping their knuckles on a bagel, listening for a hollow sound, which indicates doneness, and subsequently ripping the bagel apart with the exerted theatrics one might display while having a phone book. He describes the practice as largely unnecessary and a little macho. As far as bagels go, he says, fine feathers make fine birds. Quote, you'll want to look for the visual indicators, micro blisters, a shimmery crust, a bit of color. He picks up a poppy seed bagel. Slightly blue, he observes. It's the most beautiful thing. Production wraps up around 9 a.m., and it's time to head to the farmer's market. Henrion gives the kitchen a final once-over. There's lots of seeds on the floor, he says. That's part of life. He started tinkering with bagel recipes in 2020, several months after he dropped out of a Ph.D. program in New York City and moved to Durham with his partner, Carly, who had enrolled in a Ph.D. program at Duke. He'd been laid off from his barista job at the onset of the pandemic, around the time that many people, bored at home, developed a sudden interest in baking. Henrion, who missed New York bagels, jumped on the bandwagon, but bagels aren't any just any bread, though. Months later, when other hobbyists were conquering and growing tired of sourdough, brioche, and focaccia, Henrio still had to produce a satisfactory bagel. He plowed ahead, making spreadsheets to map out variables like humidity, fermentation time. His bagels began to improve enough to the point where he could share them with friends, who then urged him to start selling them to the public. He threw together a website and began distributing pickup orders at the community garden down the street from his house. And he says, for the first few weeks, it was just people from the neighborhood. Then I started seeing people I didn't know, people from other neighborhoods. You sort of realize, if we could scale this up and get better at what we're doing, maybe we can have a viable business. In the months that followed, traffic continued to accelerate, and Henrion started offering delivery service. Besides the obvious Brugger's, Durham only has one dedicated bagel shop, Everything Bagels. That's in the Durham Food Hall. Isaac's Bagels was filling a glaring gap in the market. An outpouring of community support enabled Henrion to keep pace with the growing demand. When the operation became too large for Henrion's kitchen, Larry Greenblatt, a doctor whom Henrion befriended while volunteering for Greenblatt's mask distribution initiative in the early pandemic days, offered his own spacious kitchen as an alternative. A particularly generous proposition given the early hours that Henrion's baking process would begin on Saturdays. The offers kept coming. In late 2021, the owners of Ideal's Sandwich and Grocery hosted an Isaac Bagel pop-up. A bagel residency at Queenie's came soon after. Michelle Vanderwalker, who co-owns Queenie's, said Isaac was very impressively committed to growing his business, to finding the right next step and doing it well. Support from Vanderwalker and from other local restaurateurs extended beyond pop-up opportunities, Henrion says. On a Friday night last October, Hurricane Ian knocked out power in the commissary kitchen, leaving Henrion with 2,000 dough rings and no refrigeration. He sent out a plea to Queenie's and 9th Street Bakery at 1:30 a.m., asking if he and his employees, who notably also responded to his middle-of-the-night phone call, could use their kitchens to bake. Both said yes. Henrion, who didn't have commercial kitchen or entrepreneurship experience prior to launching Isaac's, had also worked to gain industry knowledge from his network of Durham restaurant friends. Vanderwalker says he asked great questions of us. Paul Chirico, who co-owns Ideals, says Henrion is cut out for the industry. He hasn't really worked in kitchens, says the New York native, but he's perfect for it. He's always trying to get better, trying to improve. That's what you need to be successful. And Henrion is not seeking advice just from other business owners. Since the inception, Henrion has placed an extraordinary emphasis on customer input, according to Greenblatt. Quote, he would have people fill out a form and rate all the characteristics of the bagels. Is it the right texture? Chewy enough? What about the size? Is it too salty or not salty enough? He did this iteration after iteration until he got the bagels where he wanted them to be. If Henrian wasn't so serious about his craft, it could be the setup to a joke. A former computer scientist wants to open a bagel business in a town he just moved to. What route would he take, if not the scientific method? What kind of bagel science would he be if his product weren't peer-reviewed? When the brick-and-mortar location of Isaac's opens in the fall, service will be takeout only. Henrian says he envisions the shop as a place where students and workers can grab a sandwich and a coffee on their way to school or work, the way he did when he lived in New York. I'm sure there'll be some moments of invention and creativity, he says, but we're planning to be relatively traditional. Beyond a selection of bagels and cream cheeses, the menu will include hot and cold bagel sandwiches, deli staples like whitefish salad, egg salad, lox, and a mix of pastries and sweets. The future Isaac's Bagel space is just two blocks away from the community garden where Henrian got his start. It's a nice touch of poetry, the bagel maker coming full circle. Now, just a minute or so left to tell you about what I didn't read to you today from the print edition of Indie Week. The Triangle's Kids Notes is back. It's a music enrichment program for young children. It needs financial resources to stay afloat. Then M.I. Lenderman, head of a Cat's Cradle show, talks basketball, Breeze DJ, pancake, and self-deprecation. A new local initiative, the School for Living Futures, launches a series on climate activism and creativity. And John Waters, who performs at the Carolina Theater this week, quote, I am the filthiest person alive, even though Johnny Knoxville is pretty close. Well, I am at the end of our episode today, Indie Week, John Federson here. This program will be available in our podcast section after our initial Friday broadcast, and that's at ncreadingservice.org. So I will bid you good day, and I will be back, presumably, if there's another issue, I'll be there to read it to you from the North Carolina Reading Service. Thanks very much for listening to Indie Week.